thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
This morning's Bible reading is from Matthew 16, verse 21 to 28, and it's titled, Jesus Predicts His Death. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed on the third day and be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said, this shall never happen to you. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Truly, I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom.
Thanks, Ruth. Good morning. Good to have you here this morning. Just a really brief kind of report. We had our AGM on Wednesday. Some of you were there, and I often will give a bit of an update on a Sunday morning about the things that were talked about or decided. I'm not going to do that. You'll be hearing about them in the weeks and months to come, but if you're desperate for news from the AGM, come see me afterwards. No one saw me after the first service, so I'm not holding my breath. But if you're desperate to know what happened, please, by all means, hit me up. It's not a secret. It's just no one cares, apparently. So I don't know if you've ever thought about the turning points in your lives, but there are events that take place in our lives that define our lives in particular ways, right? There are events that take place, decisions that we make, that define our lives. And what that means is that it makes certain things that used to be possible no longer possible because of a decision made. So, in my case, when I was thinking about my life, a turning point was when I met Nicole, my wife. I met my wife, and that defined my life in particular ways. And a whole bunch of things that might have been possible before I met her are no longer possible. So, I may have been able to convince another woman to marry me. That might have been possible, right? But I didn't have to worry about it, which was kind of nice, I have to say. I might have continued and gone on into ministry, but I wouldn't be in Australia. At Guymyr Baptist Church, I'd probably be in Canada somewhere. And while I may have had three daughters, they wouldn't play soccer. They'd play a real sport. No, sorry. Did I say that out loud? I said that out loud, didn't I? So my life has been defined by that decision, by that change, by that meeting. And I think all of us kind of understand that principle, right? There are things that take place in our lives that define our lives, that kind of focus our lives in particular ways and make certain things no longer possible and define the path before us. And this is not just true in our individual lives, it's also true in the gospel. And the passages that we're looking at today and last week and next week essentially define Jesus' ministry in a really significant way. The turning point is when Peter states that Jesus is the Messiah, when he actually acknowledges and recognizes that the disciples understand that Jesus is the Messiah. This marks a turning point. And all of a sudden, Jesus begins to define his ministry. He defines what he means by Messiah. And he does it in ways that kind of limit and exclude a whole bunch of other options. You know, as Nicolai mentioned, the disciples, I believe, felt that Jesus was going to come and lead a rebellion, that he would eventually go to Jerusalem and that he was going to go to Jerusalem in order to kind of raise an army, to kind of start the whole process of bringing in the kingdom of God through the political channels and through the networks of the movers and the shakers and the influential people of that day and age. And Jesus begins to define his ministry and what it means to be the Messiah in a remarkably different direction. And this is a significant turning point in the Gospels because to this point, we don't really know what Jesus is on about yet. Every so often, I wish I could go back and kind of reset my brain and read a story for the first time again so that I was surprised by the ending, that I wouldn't know how it ended up right away. And if you're reading through the Gospel with no understanding of what kind of happens, you'd have to wonder what Jesus is doing, because there's this enormous fanfare that he enters into ministry with, and yet then he just goes around teaching and healing. He doesn't seem to have any intent of establishing a geopolitical kingdom. He doesn't seem to be too intent on doing the sorts of things that we would expect him to do. So when it comes to this point, this turning point, he all of a sudden kind of starts to say, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I could be about, but I am not. Here is the definitive central work of the Messiah, and that is that he is going to suffer and die and be raised to life. Now that is a defining prediction, isn't it? A whole bunch of things that the disciples may have believed were going to happen are now excluded. He's not going to go and establish some sort of kingdom. He's not going to come in power. He's not going to kind of raise an army. No, he is going to suffer and die and be raised to life. And we know that there's been some antagonism. The religious leaders are not really big fans of Jesus at this point in time. They've already begun to plot his demise. We also know that, you know, John the Baptist had lost his life for much less than what Jesus is doing at this point in time. And so it's a dangerous sort of place. But Jesus doesn't even have just a premonition about this. He doesn't say to his disciples, you know what, it might get a little bit dangerous. He actually says this is what must take place. It must take place. And commentators often note that when the must is used, this it is necessary. In the Greek, it's this divine necessity. It's necessary because God has willed it as such. This is what Jesus begins to teach. And in case we kind of miss it, he teaches about his death, his suffering, his death, and his resurrection three times in the Gospels. And then the last part of the Gospels, chapters 28 to 28 in Matthew, is all taken up with the last week of his life. This is the most important part as far as Matthew's concerned. The Gospel, which has moved at quite a pace, all of a sudden slows right down to pay a lot of attention to the details that take place this last week of Jesus' life. And on three occasions, in chapter 16, chapter 17, and chapter 20, Jesus talks specifically about his death. This is a really significant thing. But there's something really interesting about this little passage that was just read for us, that Jesus begins to explain to his disciples that he's going to go to Jerusalem and suffer and die and be raised to life. Did you notice, and you probably didn't because we're so used to the story, we're too familiar with it. I didn't notice it until this week, really. Jesus does not say why he's going to die. Did you notice that? They say, you're the Messiah. He goes, you're right, I am the Messiah. And the Messiah has to go to Jerusalem and has to suffer and has to die and has to be raised to life. But he doesn't tell us why. The why doesn't actually come until really the night before he's betrayed, when he takes bread and breaks it, right? We're going to be looking at that on Good Friday, not to kind of ruin the ending, but that's what we're going to be looking at on Good Friday. Because that's when finally Matthew kind of, shall we say, answers the question. Because to this point, we think that Jesus is going to change the world in some really significant sort of way, and he certainly is, but we're not sure how. And then he's the Messiah, and he acknowledges that he's the Messiah, and we go, that's fantastic. And then he says, as the Messiah, I'm going to suffer and die. And we're like, ha ha, how's that going to work? And Jesus doesn't answer the question yet about what it means for him to die. Instead, what we find is that the predictions of his death becomes an opportunity to talk about what it means to follow him. So if you have your Bibles with you, have a quick look at these passages. In chapter 16, the passage that was read for us, Jesus teaches that he must suffer and die. And then right away, Peter takes him aside and says, never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. And what it seems to be is some sort of clash of expectations that Peter expected, as I think we would, that if God sends his anointed one to establish God's kingdom, and it's the fulfillment of all those Old Testament scriptures, and it's with the power of God, you would expect that the Messiah wouldn't die. It's kind of a natural expectation, wouldn't you think? So when Peter hears Jesus say that as the Messiah, I'm going to suffer and die, we have this clash of expectations, and Peter kind of takes the Lord aside. I love this, don't you? Takes Jesus aside and says, listen, Jesus, love your work. Really good teacher. Love what you do with the Old Testament. But you've missed something really significant about being the Messiah, and that is that you don't die. That's dumb, right? Did you hear Jesus' response? Get behind me, Satan. The thought, the association of the Messiah with victory in a military sense, the association of the Messiah with a geopolitical kingdom is, as far as Jesus is concerned, a satanic idea. That's pretty hard line, isn't it? And then he goes on to teach what? Not about the significance of his death, but to talk about what it means to follow him. What does he say? Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. And notice that's the first time that we've heard mention of the cross. Jesus didn't talk about his own death by crucifixion in this first prediction. Here's the first mention of the cross, that cruel implement of torture that was reserved for the worst of criminals, a humiliating and shameful sort of death. Here's the very first mention of it. And in case you think that maybe that's just a coincidence that Jesus' first prediction might end up with consequences for followers, it happens in the other places as well. If you turn to chapter 17, verses 22 and 23, and they came together in Galilee, Jesus said to his disciples, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day, he will be raised to life. There's a little curious tale about the temple tax at the end of chapter 17. And then in chapter 18, at that time, so in the same time that Jesus is teaching about the prediction of his death, the disciples came to him and said, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He called a little child to him and placed the child among them and said, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, and whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. Now, the issue is not about becoming more innocent or more naive. The issue is actually about becoming someone who has no influence, no status, no kind of value add, right? Children in our day and age are quite valued, but in antiquity, they were, well, you just kind of waited to see if they grew up to adults, right? All sorts of reasons why, but children had, and still have, they don't have a lot of wealth. They got wonderful networks with their friends, but not with anyone who's like really significant, right? They don't have networks of the movers and shakers. They don't have any experience behind them at this point in time. And so kids, there's not much they can offer, right? As parents, you kind of get this whole thing, right? You give lots to your children and they give you a tie for Father's Day, right? Which is fine if you ever wore ties. Again, not that I'm bitter about that at all, right? But we kind of get this, don't we? But Jesus is saying a little bit more than a kind of parent-child relationship, in which that makes perfect sense. He's basically saying that if you want to be great in the kingdom of heaven, you basically need to be someone who doesn't look to their own status, their own influence, their own power, their own value. And you have to welcome people who can do nothing for you. That's the whole thing about welcoming a child, right? You welcome a child, they can't pay you back in like kind. They're just not capable of doing that. They don't have the networks, they don't have the experience, they don't have the power, they don't have the wealth to pay you back in like kind. You are to welcome those who can do absolutely nothing for you. That's twice. Have a look in chapter 20. Because in chapter 20, it's perhaps even more explicit. Verse 17 of chapter 20, Jesus was going to Jerusalem, and on the way he took the 12 aside and said, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and, for the first time, we're told, crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and at the other at your left in your kingdom, positions of authority and power. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus rolled his eyes and said, no, sorry. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. And Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. instead. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and here's a hint about what his death is about, and to give his life as a ransom for many. But notice, each time Jesus talks about and predicts his death, his suffering, death, and resurrection, that each occasion actually becomes a focus of discussion about what it means to follow him. The meaning, the significance of his death, the significance of his resurrection is left until later in the story, but these predictions are essentially wrapped around what it means to follow him. And did you pick the theme in that? It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. Become like a child and welcome those who can do absolutely nothing to help you. And then to become great, make sure you serve everybody else. Become their slave. That's following Jesus. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? And essentially, you know, when we think about this kind of strategy going forward, it makes a little bit of sense. We looked a couple weeks ago now, I think it was, at Isaiah 42, when Jesus says that his strategy, right, to bring about justice is actually not to quarrel or cry out and not to break bruised reeds and not to extinguish smoking wicks. This kind of gentle approach needs a different kind of Messiah, and we have a very different type of Messiah. One here who is not going to bring violence, but is going to allow violence to be done to him. One who is not going to kind of force people to do what he wants, but is actually going to submit himself to the will of the Father. And at the end of the day, essentially, what following Jesus is all about is actually about that act of submission. Jesus submits himself to the will of the Father, and we are called to do the same. Now, submission is a bit of a kind of funny word, isn't it? When we talk about submission, we often talk about just one half of it. But submission actually has two, shall I say, emotional halves. Right? On the one hand, submission includes an acceptance of the authority or the privilege or the rights or the strength or the sovereignty, whatever it might be, of the one or the institution to whom we are submitting, right? That acceptance is often based in a sense of trust, right? And when we talk about submission in a positive sense, we often emphasize that, don't we? Right? If you trust somebody, if you know that they are out for your good, if they are concerned with your benefit, then submission to that individual or that group or whoever it might be is a little bit easier. But there's an acceptance that someone else has the right, has the strength, has the position, and I must submit to that. You with me so far? That's the positive side. We very rarely, however, talk about the negative side, which is actually part of submission as well. And that is, if there's acceptance on one side, there's an apprehension on the other. Right? We use the word submission rather than surrender. Right? Surrender is a little bit different, isn't it? In a surrender situation, I fought as hard as I could for as long as I could, and now you know what? There's nothing more for me to do. In fact, I know that the only way I'm going to get anything out of this deal is if I surrender. There's an acceptance, but the emphasis is actually on the apprehension, isn't it? Right? This is not going to end well for me, and I need to surrender. Submission is a little bit different. There's the acceptance, but there's also the apprehension. Because while I may trust the person that I'm submitting to at the end of the day, there is no guarantee that it's going to work out for my benefit. Because if there is a guarantee, then that's not submission, that's a contract. Right? Where we work out what I receive and what you receive, and we both sign on the dotted line and we're equals. Submission has a sense that I'm accepting your authority, but I'm also, if I'm honest with myself, I'm a little apprehensive about how this is actually going to work because there is no guarantee. Jesus submitted himself to the will of the Father. Think about the Garden of Gethsemane and tell me that there wasn't just, that there was more than acceptance there. Wasn't there also apprehension? Father, if there is any other way, take this cup from me. But not my will, but yours. Apprehension, acceptance come together to form submission. This is the central place of following Jesus. We've been saying for a while, all the way through this series, that Jesus makes no demands on people to begin to follow him, right? If you have a willingness to begin to explore what it means to follow Jesus, then you're welcome to follow him. You don't have to believe him to begin to follow him. You don't have to get your act together to begin to follow him. You don't actually have to know much to begin to follow him. But as we've also been saying, eventually you come to the point in time when there is a crisis of faith. And the crisis of faith is ultimately right here. It's right here. Between whether or not you accept with some form of trust that Jesus is who he says he is and will do what he says he will do, and the apprehension that we have about what that actually means for our lives. There's the crisis of faith, the submission that we're called to. And I think we need to be honest with ourselves and acknowledge both sides of those. Some of you who have begun to explore Jesus are probably more than a little bit apprehensive about what that actually means. That's part of this whole thing. And so if you have begun to follow Jesus, while Jesus doesn't, even in these prediction passages, he doesn't demand that people make the decision. You need to know it's coming, and it sits right there. The distinction between the grappling with the apprehension and the acceptance of who Jesus is. That's on the one side. But for those of us who have begun to follow Jesus, who have placed our faith in him, this doesn't go away. The act of submission is not a one-off act. We even see that in Jesus' life, don't we? I mean, Jesus submits himself to the Father's will at the very beginning in his baptism, right? And John the Baptist says, listen, I don't think I should baptize you. I don't think that's necessary. And Jesus says, let it be so for now so that all things can be fulfilled. Okay. And then he's immediately driven into the wilderness to submit to the will of the Father. And here in the Garden of Gethsemane, we find the same thing. And the same thing is true then for us who have begun to follow after Jesus. That ongoing act of submission to the will of the Father, which continues to have both apprehension and acceptance associated with it. And it's so easy for us to, well, stop submitting, isn't it? About 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, I was in one of those spaces where I felt pulled in a million different directions. You've probably had that experience before. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, just, you know, lots of stuff's happening, lots of stuff's always happening. But what was different about this experience of feeling pulled in 1,000 directions is that I was actually pretty cranky about it. People were making reasonable demands of my time because of commitments that I had made or whatever it might be, and I was getting cranky about it. As I've been reading through the Bible this year, I happened to be reading through Mark's Gospel, and one morning going into the college on Tuesday, I happened to read the section in Mark's Gospel, which talks about the same thing that Jesus talks about in chapter 20 here, that the Son of Man came to serve, not to be served. And in one of those kind of moments where the Holy Spirit kind of speaks to you all in one big hit, I just realized that I had decided for some reason and at some point in time that I wanted to be served. And the reason why I was so put off by all these reasonable demands in my time was that they weren't putting my benefit first. They were actually asking for me to serve other people, and I had subtly decided that, you know what? I should be served. My rights should be looked after. Me first. And I was pretty cranky about it. I realized how easy it is to slip back into that sense of not submitting anything to the Father's will, not denying myself, not wanting to be a servant, not wanting to be served, not wanting to be a child, but just wanting to be the important person. Wanting to be the one that everyone deferred to be the one that everyone thinks of first. And that's not the way of discipleship. It's just not the way of discipleship. And so this is not a one-off. This is not a matter of, say, you have your one crisis of faith and then you're done. You're done submitting. Just do it once and whew, easy sailing after that. It's an ongoing act of submission. An ongoing act of grappling with not only our apprehension, but also the acceptance, the trust, and the fear, holding them together in this act of submission to the things that God wants. This is following Jesus. And again, we haven't even yet, in the gospel story, gotten to the significance and meaning of his death. But that still comes. But Jesus has made it very, very clear that there is something in his death that is essential, not only to what it means for him to be who he is, but also essential for what it means for us to follow after him. And so I leave you with that challenge, to figure out what it means for us to continually submit ourselves, to submit our dreams, our desires, our rights, our privileges to the will of the Father. And perhaps it's appropriate then for us to take some time to celebrate communion this morning. Because even if, you know, as we're reading through the story and we kind of know the ending and we know the significance of the death of Jesus, we know that this is more than just an example of submission, that in his death and in his resurrection, in the midst of all of his suffering, he has won for us not only forgiveness and freedom and life, but perhaps for us today, we can grapple just with that example. As we take these little pieces of bread and little cups of juice, remember and we be reminded that Jesus himself submitted himself to the will of the Father. And that there was even for Jesus an element of apprehension of what that would mean, but ultimately an acceptance of the Father's love, the Father's goodness, the Father's authority. And in that act of submission, he won for us life. And he calls us to the same. Perhaps this morning will be for you what my Tuesday morning was a number of weeks ago. A realization that you have, in both subtle ways and not so subtle ways, decided that you ought to be the one who is served. That you've decided that your rights, that your privileges, that who you are is the most important thing really. And that you're starting to defend your benefit, that you're starting to hedge your bets, instead of submitting yourself to the will of the Father.